Chelsea Doohan, at age 16, playing her cello in Woods Hole.
I hadn't had a lesson yet, and I was just playing around with it. It's kind of funny, I had no idea what it was and how it was gonna make music. It's kind of strange. It's sort of an intense love-hate relationship I have with my cello, because it's really frustrating sometimes, and it's lonely. I remember a competition that I did, and I remember warming up for that competition, and it just gelled. It wasn't like I was working at it anymore. It was like I was hearing it happen by itself. Now that I'm a cellist, it's even more amazing to hear the sound of the cello in the hands of someone who's really good at it.
You're listening to the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH Radio.
We're talking with Kurt Meine. He's the editor of the Library of America's Aldo Leopold, The Essential Writings of a Visionary American Environmentalist. The world we live in today is vastly different from the early 20th century when Leopold was alive. We have a global economy, incredible advancements in technology, communications, and science. We've come so far, yet we're still grappling with many of the fundamental issues that Aldo Leopold wrote about. What do you see as the critical steps we need to take to ensure the future for both ourselves and the environment?
That is the ultimate question, isn't it? Well, let me jump into it with a little bit of going back to the history briefly. Put yourself again at the end of Leopold's life, last three years. World War II's over in 1945. He only has three more years to live. So he lived just long enough to see this new globalized world that we exist in emerging. Economic globalization was beginning to pick up steam. The globalization of conservation concerns really first expresses itself in those couple years right after World War II. So the world we live in now is sort of formed in embryo right after World War II. And Leopold did anticipate so many of these major trends and understood that. I mean, I think the simplest way of understanding this is science was advancing at a phenomenal rate through the war and immediately afterwards. And Leopold was a scientist, but he understood that science, unmoored from ethics and coupled with economic growth the way it had been defined up till that point, was going to lead us into places we weren't sure we wanted to go, especially if you had conservation conscience. And so he put his energies in those last few years into understanding the relationships among these different fields, ethics, economics, ecology. And that the fruit of that was what he called the land ethic. We talk about environmental ethics now. We use different terminology, but fundamentally, I think the outlines of the problem are still the same. How do we adjust our scientific understanding of the world and our technological tools to our emerging ethical systems and to this economic juggernaut, is the term he used in his own day, but this powerful economic world we've created? And those are big, complicated questions, but they're pretty simple in their fundamentals. We know that our natural systems and our human social cultural systems are interlinked in complex, complicated ways, and they evolve together. The question is, can we direct that evolutionary process in a way that sustains and enhances both the human and natural community, or are we going to do so in a way that degrades them and leave the mess to future generations? Leopold says, no, we can't leave it to future generations. We all have a responsibility as individuals, as members of communities, as citizens in larger in the larger society and democracy, to finding our way forward. And we need the science. We will always need information, but we also need a sense of our ethical commitments to evolve to help us understand these new challenges and these emerging relationships.
And, you know, there are obviously some people who take that responsibility a little more seriously than others. As we talk, there are people who are not so connected with nature as maybe we once were. As we talk, when we were growing up, we were outside a lot. And, you know, people get busy with their lives. They're indoors. And they may not really realize on many levels, or they're closing their eyes, let's say, to things that are happening and keeping that whole balance. I just think of, you know, the wildlife that we push out as we kind of, you know, spread out with development and how important that balance is. So for folks who are really paying attention to that and want to make a difference, it's incredibly frustrating when you can't get everybody on board, right?
It's a big task. Leopold said, you know, he said, it's taken us 19 centuries to figure out better human-to-human conduct, and our job is only half done there. It may take us as long to figure out healthier human-land relationships. Yeah, it's frustrating. We live in a world that is increasingly removed from the land. That doesn't just mean urban people either.
Right.
It means in our rural landscapes as well, which are essentially urban industrial landscapes in many places because of the way agriculture has changed. There's a phrase, we use it in the film, and I've been using it a lot lately. It's a kind of a simple statement of Leopold's in which he said, the phrase is, the destruction of soil is the most fundamental kind of economic loss the human race can suffer. Mm. He's writing in the Dust Bowl years. Mm-hmm. It's a crisis,
right.
The loss of soil. And now when I use it, I'll say to audiences, when was the last time you ever heard a leading economist or a political pundit on television, or a leading political figure talk about soil?
So important.
Or water in this way. It's fundamental. It's the basis on which all our wealth and health rests, and yet it's not a part of our conversation. Mm-hmm. We don't think of a connection between soil and economics. Well, we can't afford that anymore, and so how do we bring economics back to reality? Is the big question. There are more and more soil scientists and economists who are talking to each other and beginning to make those connections, and obviously other fields as well. But it's up to all of us to be the leaders, because frankly, those who, if I had to say it, those who rise to positions of power and authority in our culture are not there because they think deeply about soil.
Mm-hmm.
We are the ones, when I say we at the ground level in our communities everywhere, who have to be rebuilding our economies from the bottom up, and our cultures and our communities. And that's the essential lesson. The health of all these systems is intertwined. The health of our landscapes, the health of our economies and communities, our physical health and well-being. Mm-hmm. These are all tied together.
Do you feel like, though, that there are more people paying attention to that now? I mean, I'm just thinking, you know, there's all this, the local food movement and looking at, you know, water quality and maybe not to where we'd like it to be, but do you feel like there's a little bit more sense of what's happening and people wanting to, you know, do the right thing?
I think I do. We all have days when we look at the world and we say
what's going on?
We need more. Again, it's the glass full or empty part.
Exactly.
Absolutely. The way I sometimes put it is, look, we may not be solving our problems more effectively than we did 10 or 20 or 50 years ago, but we're beginning to think in the way that is necessary if we're ever going to solve them. There are more and more people who see those connections and act on those questions and organize on those questions and do things at the local level. It's one thing to pass a law in your state capital or in Washington or develop international treaties and so forth and so on. But if it's not making a difference in your local community, it's not hitting home. It's not coming home to where it's needed. So you mentioned the local food movement. I think it's incredibly powerful and important, and it's not going away.
No, it's growing.
It's growing, and it will continue. I see it back home in Wisconsin very powerfully. It's as important as anything that's happened, I think, in conservation in the last century, because it really is making the connections meaningfully, personally, directly, locally, in ways that, as important and necessary as it was to pass the laws we passed in the 70s or do the other things we've done. This is where we as individuals can really, really hook into those larger questions in a tangible way.
Mm. And I also wonder what your thoughts are on children, because, you know, taking the local food movement as one example, we have kids now who are getting back to nature through gardening. We have, you know, some of the food banks who've created gardens. Of course, there are community gardens. There's some great programs like over in the Vineyard. There's the Farm Institute that, you know, teaches these kids. And kids who respond to this by, you know, who would never eat broccoli, and now they've grown the broccoli and they love the broccoli. You know, it's really connecting with
they have a relationship to their food now, and it's not purely as a consumer.
Yeah.
And that's a post-World War II phenomenon, you know. That is one of those changes that Leopold, again, anticipated and saw coming, but didn't live long enough to be fully involved in. But it was after World War II that the agricultural systems began to become the modern industrial behemoths that they are. And so we lost our relationship to food, in a sense. And the food movement, in all of its various expressions, has reconnected people, whether as, again, consumers, but in a new and different way, as producers. And you don't have to be out in a rural area. Again, there's a thriving urban agriculture movement. Yeah. As preparers and processors, it's changing the economy at that level. So all the links in the food chain from the soil to your own guts has been going through an evolutionary change, and all of them oriented toward hopefully a healthier way of thinking about our relationship through food to the rest of the natural world. Yeah.
So you are in Woods Hole for a seminar on the history of sustainability science organized by the Marine Biological Laboratory. So tell us a little bit more about these conversations.
Yeah, it's pretty unprecedented in my experience, and I've been reading and writing on this for a number of years now. We all know the term sustainability now. It's kind of taken over a lot of our conversations in conservation. The term is not so important as the ideas. And so this group has come together, a partnership of the lab here in Arizona State University, to ask the question, where does this come from? What's the history of sustainability science? And Leopold didn't use that term, for example, but his work is essential to understanding the deep roots of our modern thinking about how to sustain ourselves and our natural systems as well, and how to enhance them and build and work with them. So this group includes we've just introduced ourselves earlier this morning, but it includes philosophers and ethicists and biologists and historians and scientists of different stripes. And so I'm looking forward to the full few days I have ahead of me here, because this really hits home for me. This is a part of my own thinking and writing over the years that I thought I was alone in some ways. And I see there's this great room of people here who've been gathered together to understand how we began to ask these questions. Who were the people? What were the ideas and concepts? What were the institutions? Where we failed? Where have we made progress? How did we learn to connect different fields of knowledge? And that's really, to me, the most interesting thing is, especially people in the academic world, they get split up into their different specialties. Mm-hmm. And sustainability is all about finding the links between different fields of knowledge of economics and psychology and sociology, along with the natural sciences, all of them, from climatology to paleontology to botany to zoology to marine biology, 100 other fields. And then this humanistic dimension, the ethics, literature, philosophy, storytelling, all of these things come together in what we now call sustainability. Other generations had other words for it, but for the time being, that's what we use. And so this is a very special opportunity to have probably the most in-depth conversation about the origins of these ideas, more so than any other conversation I've ever been a part of.
What does that lead to? You know, you have these conversations. How does it, work in the bigger picture?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it helps people orient themselves in their own areas of interest. You could be interested in working, say, in the food arena, as we just talked about, or you're working in, you know, the problems confronting our ocean systems. And you folks here know this better than anyone. Or on and on, all the different climate change and so forth. When you understand the history and the human story of how knowledge evolves and how fields come together to help us ask the right questions and hopefully provide some good answers, it enriches your own work, helps you recontextualize, it helps to see your own work in a different context. And if we do our work well, it will help solve problems, whether that's through the policy arena, or in our own home places as citizens, in our home institutions, whatever they may be, in our own personal relationships and families and other dimensions of our lives. So there may be some immediate tangible results of this coming through new papers and new academic programs and so forth. Yeah. I think for the students who are here, this is especially important, and most of this is for students. This is something they won't normally get in their own programs back at their home universities. It's pretty odd to have students in a particular specialty even understand the history of their specialty. I find this deeply ironic, and it's always troubled me. That's why I'm very happy to be here. It gives a chance for students to do something they rarely get to do, understand the roots of their own field of expertise.
Right. Well, you know, you said something that just, again, it seems so simple, yet it makes so much sense, and that's the links. I mean, to bring these different fields and different studies together, because sometimes there's a relationship there that is really important that you may not have realized. You know, there's a, you know, you're studying over in this area and the answer may lay over here with the research somebody's doing. And when you connect them together, it's such a powerful thing.
And not just other researchers. You remind me of a little project I've been involved with. It's called Long-Term Ecological Reflections Program. To make a long story short, this is a program that pairs ecologists and other scientists with artists. Mm. And poets and ethicists, puts them together in the field. And at first, when this idea was proposed, you can imagine some of the scientists were said, I don't know if I want to take my precious time to hang out with a bunch of artists. But what they found is in doing this and looking at long-term patterns of ecological change, the artists were asking questions that the scientists were not thinking about.
Right.
And pointing out things and observing things in very different nonlinear ways. And it became a wonderful collaboration. This started out in Oregon, but now it's expanding to places all over the country.
Absolutely. We've done some programs here about that, you know, art and science coming together and some really fabulous collaborations, as you're saying, and you know, bringing questions we hadn't thought of before and sometimes answers we hadn't thought of.
And the artists from their side, they have a chance to see the world through a different set of eyes, too, and understand the rational side. Mm-hmm. You can think of it that way. But I think, creative spirits find each other and they find the connections that need to be made. And that's, again, think of Leopold in this. Leopold was renowned as a early leading ecologist, but he's best known now because of his writing.
Mm.
That's what people remember him for.
Well, you know, you would think scientists and artists would be they really do have much more in common than you might think.
Yeah, they're supposed to be. I mean, we're always trying to emphasize our differences, but the truth is we're all human beings.
Right. Any final thoughts on Leopold you'd like to leave us with?
Oh, well, I'll leave you with the thought we leave at the end of our documentary film. At the end of Green Fire, we make a point that I've made often in my talks over the years, and that is this shift in philosophy that he called for, this idea that we need to think of ourselves as part of the larger community that he called the land. The evolution of that ethic is not something that one person does or defines. He wrote an essay called The Land Ethic, but in his own essay, he says no one writes an ethic, that it evolves in the minds of a thinking community. An ethic is an expression of a community talking to itself and trying to figure out the changes needed in its relationships. And so what he did in that statement says, we're all part of this conversation. We all have to be part of that conversation. We all have to bring to it our experiences, our knowledge, our traditions, our values, our commitments. And so, you know, the conversation will continue and it must continue. And Leopold both inspires us in that way, but he also frees us to say it's not just one person's mm-hmm. product. It's all of our, it's our collective conversation about where we're going.
Right. And maybe we need to get outside a little more.
Yeah, absolutely.
Kurt Meine is the editor of the Library of America's Aldo Leopold, The Essential Writings of a Visionary American Environmentalist. He's also has a new film called Green Fire, Aldo Leopold and a Land Ethic for Our Time. Thanks so much for coming in and chatting with us. Really enjoyed it.
It's wonderful to be here in Woods Hole. I've heard about this place for a long time, and thank you so much for having me.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
Amy Vins produces The Point, with assistance from Jenny Junker. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter. The Point is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.